All right, why don't we go ahead and get started? Can everyone hear me? Yes, all right. I see a number of familiar faces for those who I'm not familiar with. My name is Dr. Ben Hopkins. I'm the director of the Seeger Center and the co-director of the East Asia National Resource Center. It's my great privilege to welcome you today to the book launch of Professor Michael Yehuda's latest edition of the International Politics of East Asia, of Asia and the Pacific. So, available for purchase just outside the door, I would add. It's my pleasure, not only because Michael is a longstanding fellow of the Seeger Center, but also, as I've told him on a number of occasions, he was my professor when I was an undergraduate at the London School of Economics. So there's a nice little circularity to today's event. Michael Yehuda is an emeritus professor of international relations who taught at the London School of Economics from 1973 to 2003. As I mentioned, he's a visiting scholar at the Seeger Center here at the Elliott School. He's also been a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a research fellow at ANU in Canberra, as well as a visiting professor at the University of Adelaide. In addition to these, he's also been a visiting scholar at the Fairbanks Center in Harvard and the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore, as well as a visiting scholar for the Chinese Foreign Affairs University. He's acted on numerous occasions as an advisor to the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, as well as consulted numerous organizations in London and Singapore, and has had a long history of media appearances on the BBC, as well as other media appearances. He's published a whopping 10 books, which I think any academic would find both intimidating and humbling, and over 200 chapters and articles in various journals and books. And it's his latest book, The International Politics of Asia and the Pacific, that we're here to talk about today. Now, as I mentioned, there are copies of this available for sale just outside the door, but we also have a special, with Michael's consent, a special offer today, a signed copy. Whoops, I better open it up to that page. There we go. The signed copy, which we will be raffling off later this afternoon. How can you get into this amazing offer today? Well, to be eligible to receive your book by 2 p.m. this afternoon, please follow us on Instagram and Twitter and make a comment or observation about today's talk, and we will raffle this off with the winner getting, again, the signed copy here. For those of you that don't get quite so lucky, again, there are numerous copies outside, so I would really highly recommend this. I think we're in for a special treat today, a real tour de force, and no doubt you're going to bring me back to my undergraduate days at LSC. So, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Michael Yehuda.
Well, Westerners are supposed to start their talks with a joke, and Asians generally start with an apology. And I have to start with an apology, not a joke, because after carefully preparing notes for today, I find that I've left them at home. So I'll have to do it off the cuff. My basic argument is that there's been sort of a huge structural change, since the beginning of this century, and it's still going on. We've gone from what Krauthammer called the unipolar moment now to considerable uncertainty, and the uncertainty in many respects antedated our current president. When the father of George Bush, the elder Bush, finished with Gorbachev, He thought that this would lead to a new world order. And he envisaged that this would be done, at that time, it would be done with him and Gorbachev. Now, as we know, that didn't happen. When there was a new world order set up, it was set up at the end of the Second World War. And those who set up the institutions and set up that order obviously wanted to ensure that there wouldn't be a repeat of another world war, that it wouldn't be like the First World War, in which the seeds for the second one were sown. And they spent 2 or 3 years developing this. And that has been, since then, that's been called the Liberal International Order. Liberal not just in economic terms, but also in political terms. And America was clearly in the lead, and America set a huge example in transforming both Germany and Japan into for more or less the whole of the period of the Cold War, as peace powers who really did not have major armies, did not have offensive capabilities. Now, those who inherited the situation after the Cold War also thought that they would set up a new order. But there was no preparation, no studies, no new institutions, nor were any institutions renewed. But this didn't stop there being hubris. Let me read what one of America's best diplomats said about it. He was the main diplomat who dealt with the Balkans. He was the diplomat who also was involved very strongly in the attempts to get an agreement with the North Koreans. So he says this: the triumphalist mood in the United States in the 1990s was palpable. No problem, no matter how gritty and entrenched in decades or centuries of miserable and sordid history, was outside our capacity to solve, usually by force. Those who did not subscribe to this worldview were supposedly trapped in the past, unable to understand the new paradigm of the new American century. Now, this is principally the Clinton period. Now, Clinton obviously did not start off with a great interest in foreign affairs. He had criticized the previous President Bush for coddling dictators, including those in Beijing. And Clinton started off by saying that the enabling of free trade with China, most favored nation as it was called, was going to be conditional on the Chinese authorities observing human rights. The American business community was in up in arms over this, and eventually Clinton gave way and renewed the trade agreements, he then had a Secretary of State who was very keen on extending democracy and the free markets. And they felt that they could do this regardless of the countries to which they were addressing themselves. It's a kind of an American conceit to think in terms of models that can be replicated and applied anywhere. And you won't be surprised to hear that the things didn't quite work out that way. But the issue of China became in many ways a key turning point for him. Because as you will probably remember, the first presidential election in Taiwan took place in 1996, which led to the president, to the election of Li Danhui. Beijing was very concerned about this and thought that they would teach the Taiwanese a lesson and that the Taiwanese would end up voting for the person that they preferred. This was a person who was going to be relatively soft on the relationship with China. And to ensure that the people in Taiwan knew that the Chinese were serious, they first fired off some missiles in 1995. And there were party elections in Taiwan, which Beijing thought were favorable. So in the spring of 96, they thought they'd do it again. And indeed, they bracketed Taiwan with missiles to the north and to the south of its two main ports. And Clinton was prevailed upon in Washington to do something about it. So he sent two battle groups led by carriers, aircraft carriers. And he was careful to let the Chinese know in advance that he was doing that. But nevertheless, the Chinese stopped their might and the Clinton administration, having been brought to what they considered to be the brink of a possible war with China, saw this as a crisis that they should address. And so, almost at the turn of a dime, Clinton sought to improve relations with China, and he and Jiang Zemin more or less set out to establish a G2. First Jiang Zemin went to Washington for a state visit, and then Clinton went to China. And while in China, he and Jiang Zemin issued a joint statement in which they pledged to pay attention to what was going on in South Asia, which of course annoyed the Indians. Clinton had what they called bypassed Japan, because normally when an American president went to East Asia, he would stop in Japan. You must remember that Japan was and still remains the main source for American power in East Asia. Absent Japan, and America will have lost its bases, will have both air bases and sea bases. It would no longer be a player in Southeast Asia. And the Japanese, to this day, have always been sensitive to the possibility that either they'd be abandoned by their main ally and defender, because they had no offensive capabilities and therefore they were dependent on the United States for their defense. So they were afraid of abandonment, but at the same time, they were afraid of being dragged in by the Americans into military conflicts that were not in their interest. And so to have Clinton go to China, of all places, without ignoring them and then criticizing them in China, because a year before, in 1996, there had been a major financial crisis in East Asia that affected the Southeast Asians, affected Korea, and what had happened was that many of the Southeast Asians had borrowed dollars based on their own currency. So they overborrowed, and so the value of their currencies went down vis-a-vis the dollar, and a huge crisis blew out. China did not devalue its currency at that time and was very much praised for it. Japan contributed something like $120 billion to the rescue of the finances of the Southeast Asian neighbors. China contributed $4 billion, and China was praised to the skies, especially here in Washington. And of course, the Japanese did not take kindly to the idea that they would be criticized in Beijing while Beijing was being praised for its efforts on the financial crisis. So Clinton, therefore, turned, if you like, 180 degrees from sending aircraft carriers to stop the Chinese from intimidating Taiwan to coddling up to Beijing. And that paved the way for engagement which has carried on until really towards the end of the Obama administration. The idea that China was not playing trade by fair rules had emerged before Trump came along, even though his people seem to say that it's only thanks to him that attention has been drawn to the way the Chinese conduct themselves as members of the World Trade Organization. Now, this idea of transforming East Asia can be seen as an inheritance from the Cold War, but there were other inheritances from the Cold War, which I'll be speaking about later, that involves obviously Korea and involves Taiwan. But much of the structure for the world in Asia as we know it today took place during the, or was set up during the Cold War. The American alliance system, the alliance with Japan, the alliance with Korea, also with the Philippines, with Thailand, and of course Australia and New Zealand. All of this was set up in the early part of the Cold War. Secondly, the idea of deterrence between nuclear powers occurred in the Cold War in Asia. During the Korean War, it came out afterwards that American and Russian planes flew close to each other, recognized each other as for what they were. Americans heard Russian spoken by so-called Korean pilots. And yet, both sides decided to keep that secret. And it wasn't until a long time afterwards that this came out. Now why? Well, Russia had, or the Soviet Union, had already got its own nuclear weapon. It had its first test in 1949. And Stalin was very concerned not to seek a conflict with the United States. He insisted that if the North Koreans were to get into difficulties, they should look to the Chinese to help them, not the Russians. And as far as China was concerned, Stalin was very keen for the Chinese to get involved, as indeed they did. But America and Russia took steps to ensure that the conflict did not spread to them. American pilots were under very strict conditions not to provoke the Russians, and vice versa. So that's not a result of the clever calculations of Herman Kahn here in the United States. It's something that emerged out of tacit understandings. And I would argue that to this day, the avoidance of nuclear war is based on tacit understandings. The Indians and the Pakistanis have not all sat together and worked out who can do what and how and so on. And likewise, the United States does not have any clear agreement with China. They don't keep on counting their respective missiles and nuclear capabilities and so on. Whether nuclear weapons are a guarantee of peace is, of course, a very different question. It's the fear of nuclear war that could happen even by unintentional actions is something which seizes all those who have nuclear weapons. Another legacy of the Cold War was the sense of a structure that affected the world as a whole, that involved the then two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. And in some respects, what we are all concerned about is the uncertainty that developed after the end of the Cold War. Now, it's worthwhile thinking through how that uncertainty developed. The United States has played a big part in that. I've already mentioned Clinton and his ignoring of the issue of human rights and democracy. Similarly, with regard to the market, that took place in many respects independently of the American government. It was done primarily through the major multinational companies. And they were the main vanguard for economic globalization. They were the ones who set up the supply chains. Now, one of the problems with that is, for academics such as me, is how to measure respective trade and respective investments. See, nowadays, on the one side, we have China, where effectively the major economic decisions are decided by the state, and the state provides the statistics, and we follow them, even though some economists argue that these are exaggerated or played around. Now, as far as the United States is concerned, a lot of their trade, a lot of their investment is done by companies in which the American government hardly knows what they do. I mean, they invest their profits in financial havens in Switzerland. And the American government had to pass a special law to get more information about the money that companies have put in Switzerland. But there are a whole number of such company, such financial havens, and that's why we know that many of these huge companies hardly pay any tax here at all.